Hello and welcome to Fun Problems, the problems of fun. I'm Peter C. Haywood.
I'm AJ Brandon.
And this is the only board game design podcast hosted by 80s action heroes.
Man, I wish I was an 80s action hero. That would be awesome.
So, weird news. It's again been 9 months since we recorded.
Flash. No, actually.
20 minutes.
Lying to you again. Also, I'm still alive.
So since then, we've published another 14 games. It's been a really big 20 minutes. AJ, what do you want to talk about today?
I thought we'd talk about designing board games. Specifically, maybe we could talk about the minimum viable prototype.
MVP? Doesn't that mean a sports thing?
You know, I don't play sports ball, but I can only assume I'm the expert on this. And no, it does not mean anything to do with sports.
MVP, most valuable player.
Yeah, I was joking.
Oh, I was like, what? I actually don't know anything about sports. I was like, I'm so sure about this. This is like one of the three things I know. P in sports means most valuable player. In business means minimum viable product. And as an offshoot of that, in board games, it means...
minimum viable prototype.
What is that, AJ?
So it means the fewest possible necessary amount of components and content and work that you need to put in to get your game onto the table and get it playtested.
And why is that valuable?
Because you can spend a lot of time working on material that is just going to get thrown out in the next build if you put in more work than you need to before you see what's proven. So, I mean, I'm sure most game designers, on my first game, I was like meticulously picking out the art for each of the cards, you know? And then I played it once and I was like, oh, this game is terrible. Why did I spend 7 hours meticulously picking up the art for 400 cards when all I needed was to have like 10 different effects? Just make, you know, if you need more cards to make the hands work, then just make duplicates of them. Yeah. And then just mess around. It's also important to note, it's not just the minimum amount of content, it's the minimum amount of effort. This is where I'm going to handwrite on cards for my first playtest. Yeah. It does not need to look pretty. It does need to be functional, but for your very first playtest or two, honestly, just barely.
Barely functional, yeah. So the reason why we're doing an episode about this at all, we actually showed a friend of ours a topic list, and we were like, what do you want to learn about? And he was like, that. I want to learn how to get better at bringing an MVP to the table. And the reason for this is because, exactly what you said, people tend to overdo their prototype, and that doesn't sound bad, but it is bad. It's bad for two reasons. What are the two reasons, AJ?
So one reason is that it's a waste of your time because you could be spending a lot of work on something that's just going to change almost immediately anyway.
Fun fact, that was not one of my two reasons. I don't value people's times. That's why these episodes are so long. I'm like, nope.
Interesting, because the second one might also not be on your list. Not getting too attached to it.
That is the core thing for me, absolutely.
So that's where you just spend so much time and effort on a thing that, consciously or not, you're going to say, well, I really love this thing that I made. I care so much about it. And you might also spend enough time on it that you think of it as something that's fundamental to the game, and it's not at all. Which I think is probably the most dangerous aspect of that.
Humans are very, very, very susceptible to the sunken cost fallacy. Second time in two episodes we've talked about this. Sunken cost fallacy is, let's say someone's like, hey, I got a gold mine. If you give me money, it'll make you a bunch more money. And you give them $100. You are more likely to give them another $100 than walk away because you've already sunken some cost into the project. So,
right, because if you put more money in, you might get your money back. But if you don't put more money in, then you definitely lost money.
Yeah. And so humans are really, really susceptible to this. So the more time you spend on a prototype, like you said, A, you get emotionally attached to it, but just as much, if not more, there's this, like, I don't want to change this. I don't want to abandon this. Like, you grow attached to it, not only emotionally, but also, like, transactionally. I don't quite know what I'm trying to say, but you get the idea.
Yeah, for sure. I think you got that across.
And the other reason is actually basically the waste of time thing, but it's subtly different, which is, just like at last episode, we were talking about knowing that I can put something together in Component Studio in 5 minutes makes me more likely to do it. If you are spending 100 hours on a prototype, when you come up with a new game idea, you're going to go like, oh, oh, 100 hours? I don't have 100 hours. I'm just not going to work on it. If you know it'll take you 5 minutes to build out a prototype, that will get to the table. And the faster a prototype gets to the table, the faster you can either decide if it's fun or not, and if not, move on to the next one. My secret board game superpower is that my ego is not attached to board games whatsoever. I want to be a screenwriter. That is my life goal. Board games are a very, very effective distraction. So I don't care if a board game is bad. I don't want to publish a board game that's bad, but when I bring an idea out, if it's not good, I just want to know that as quickly as possible so I can get on to the next one. So similarly, like, if I have an idea, I just want to get it out so we can find out if that's fun, if that's going to contribute to the world, if people are going to enjoy it. And if not, cool, I want to throw that away and move on to the next one. And new designers are often very surprised at the speed of which I abandon okay ideas. I'll bring an idea out, and people are like, oh man, that plays, that's a playable game. And I'm like, yeah, you know, was it fun? They're like, no, but maybe. I'm like, yeah, I don't care then. Like, and I'm not saying everyone should abandon ideas as fast as I do. I've been doing this for a long time now. And so I know that in my experience, when I design a game, if it's not fun by the second time it comes out to the table, I would be better off burning through more ideas until I find one that is. That's my threshold. Second time to the table, if it doesn't have that like spark of joy, I just move on to the next project.
Yeah, and I'll say I'm very much the same in terms of the way of thinking. I am not the same to the extent and to the speed. It depends, though. I mean, sometimes it's like, oh, I think this is a cool idea for a mechanic. This is a unique, never-before-done mechanic. And then I'll play it, and I'll be like, oh, you know what? That actually wasn't as fun as I thought it was. Like, I'll just give a random example.
Yeah.
I had an idea for a dexterity game where you had basically wooden sticks, and then on the ends of them, you have little workers. And the idea is you're trying to lift furniture throughout a house, and so there's like cardboard doors, and you have to like get the couch through the door without dropping and stuff like that. And in my head, I was like, oh, that could be like a cute idea, fun little gimmick. And then I basically picked them up, moved them around for like 5 seconds, and I was like, nope, not cool, not fun. And I could have spent ages tinkering away at that, but I thought that core thing would feel good. There was none of that good feeling in there, so it just wasted my time to go with it.
Yeah.
Now I honestly think that you take it too far, but I mean, different people. I can give a specific example.
What did I abandon that you're like, no, Peter, that's the next Spiel des Jahres winning game?
Cozy Hollow, my magnum opus.
That's your game. You can make that all day.
It is now. So Cozy Hollow was an idea that I had. I'm not going to go into it in too much detail, but it was basically an idea that I had that I pitched to Peter as a co-design. He was interested, and then we brought to the table a couple times. And within like 2 or 3 playtests, like Peter has said he does, he was like, you know, it's not working. You can keep the work that I've done on it if that's of any use to you, but I don't really want to do the same. Fair enough. But part of it is because of the combination specifically of the end plus the quick to abandon thing. You're very fast on both those things. And at least in that particular case, I've worked with you on a lot of other projects that didn't go that way, even if they weren't like super fun the first time. But I think in that particular case, the combination of how stripped down the game was, plus how quickly you were able to leave it, I don't think it gave the game any chance to actually show like the core fun of the game. Because basically what we were doing was just like worker placement / movement is like the core of the game. And basically, we were just like moving a worker on the board. We were like, is that fun? But none of the like fun elements, none of the hook of the game was actually in that particular build of the prototype because of how early it was. So again, no shade to Peter in any way for not wanting to work on it or for not thinking it was going to go anywhere. But that's just one example of like a very specific situation where I think it was a little quick.
I guess I'm not trying to debate, just to explain my thinking is that okay. For me, for a game to work, even that part needs to be fun.
Sure, yeah, I get
like,
that.
If that, like, so for example, the game we're working on at the moment, BattleBugs, like, it has 3 fun cores, and I think, like, that's the trick to success. I don't want to have, like, this bit's not fun, but this bit makes it fun. I want that bit to be fun, and this bit to make it fun, and this bit to make it all even more fun. So that, I'm not saying anyone else has to do my philosophy, but that's absolutely where I'm coming from. I'm like, look, if this part isn't fun, I can make a perfectly adequate game out of this after 2 years of work, but I'd rather something where this bit is fun, and then we add more fun in, and then we have a fun stew going, baby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and totally makes sense. Yeah, I completely hear you.
So, today we're going to help answer the question, how do you get game to the table as MVP as possible? What are the pitfalls? What are the techniques?
And the short answer to that is listen to our previous episode.
Yeah, the answer is Component Studio. I'm going to talk about a few different techniques that I use. And there's always a risk with these. Like, I do this for a job. This is my job. Yeah. So I'm not saying I have money to burn, but I prioritize this kind of thing. If you are working another job in a tiny apartment and your wife who doesn't want you to be working on games or a husband who's, like, allergic to paper, some of these are not going to be options to you. And that is a fact. I can only talk about my experience where I am, like, I treat this very, very seriously because this is a primary force. It's not my primary source of income, but it is a primary source of income for me, and I prioritize a lot of this stuff. So one of the big, big, big advantages that we've already mentioned about Component Studio is that it removes obstacles. My general life philosophy is the things you want to do, remove the obstacles to those things. And the things you don't want to do, put up obstacles. If you want to stop smoking, don't leave your cigarettes next to you on the desk. Put them in a high cupboard somewhere. Then you have to go get to the high cupboard. If you want to be prototyping, don't put your components in a high cupboard somewhere, because that amount of effort will stop you from getting to it. So, again, Component Studio for me is completely worth it, because I know that with two taps on my keyboard, I can have a new game open. I know that, you know, 5 minutes later, I can have a prototype in TTS. So first and foremost, removing those obstacles. One thing that I do, and actually AJ can see this on the video stream and no one else will see it. This is what I have next to me on my desk.
Oh my gosh. In public where everyone can see?
No, it's disgusting. In private. It's on my desk. I have a deck of blank cards and a marker literally sitting next to me on the desk. The other day I was on hold with my bank. And I came up with an idea. Within 20 seconds, while on hold with my bank, I was playtesting this game. Just right there on the desk. I didn't have to, again, go and open the cupboard and find the thing and do the this and do the that. Like, I could literally reach out, draw some stuff, start playtesting a prototype on my desk. That is true MVP. Seconds after I had the idea, I was playtesting it. So remove obstacles. Now, for me, I like to solo test games before I play them with other people. Is this true of you also?
No, actually. I think I'm actually pretty rare in terms of at least professional game designers, in that I have a really hard time solo playtesting. Part of it is just like my personality, my drive. Part of the reason why I love co-design so much is because a huge part of my motivation for doing things is collaboration with people. I love people, and I love working with people. And for me, a playtest is like a mini collaboration. Yeah. And that's like super fun. And for me, solo playing a game, regardless of any context, is always work.
Yeah.
And so I will try to like get through a quick round of it, you know, to make sure it doesn't just completely fall apart before playing with people. But honestly, it's hard and it's painful for me to do. And I find that I get very, very little out of solo playtesting, at least for non-solo games where I have to, like, multi-hand. Yeah. In an actual solo game, I can do a lot better with that. And, I mean, I've done dev work where I've done, like, multiple hands and everything. I can do it, but it is not pleasant.
Yeah. I mean, in this case, it was literally a solo game, so that was convenient. Right. Which I've never made a solo game, so that's why I was kind of playing with the form. So I will solo test stuff. The exception being stuff that relies on, what's it called?
Yomi.
Yomi? The Japanese word? Yeah.
Yep. As in to read your opponent, to think through what they are thinking.
Yeah.
I mean, it comes from the game Yomi, named after that. But do you want to give a more mass market example?
Yeah.
Rock, paper, scissors.
Yeah, scissors, paper, rock is the key example where, like, the entire game is what is the other person doing. Village Pillage is another one. There's another really... or Brave Rats by the same designer as Love Letter. Like, in that one, everyone has the cards 1 through 7 and you're trying to play against the other person. Like, you just can't do that solo. You can test the mechanics, so I will often test the mechanics, but if the game's essence, if its very core is like trying to read the other person, I generally don't solo test them. Everything else I'll bring to the table as a solo game. Everything. Baba Yaga is the game I mentioned last time. That one, I couldn't even work out how to make it 2-player, so I solo played 3 players multiple times before showing it to anyone else. And in the process, like, huge economy issues were resolved. So, like, in that one, I think every card was, like, twice as valuable as it needed to be or twice as expensive or something like that. I just went nowhere, and so I would play for, like, a full half hour before being like, oh, this just isn't working, cut the numbers in half, go again. So with a solo play, your MVP can be even Emma and less V. You could literally play test it with blank cards if you have a really good memory. Like, just anything to just get your hands going through the motion is all you need. So in this case, I didn't actually mean to talk about this game, but it happens to be sitting on the table next to me. The cards are literally just like three paths and you're building a little dungeon. This game might not go anywhere, but I just drew a bunch of different options for a dungeon. So like, they could go up and left or up and right, or they could cross over, or they could be a T intersection. Shuffled them up, started dealing them out. That was all I had. And I found that the process of building the dungeon was pleasing. Like, that just by itself was fun. I picked them up again. I drew some monsters on some of them. I started dealing them out. Didn't work. I was like, oh, I don't know how to do the directions here. Like, it doesn't make sense. And the ones that were literally just a corner, too limiting. So they were all T intersections some immediately and like various stuff like that. It was remarkable. Like, again, while on hold with my bank, I iterated this game twice and played it three times. And it's not even a game. Like, it's just me scrolling on blank cards. So if you can get your hand on some blank cards, I recommend putting them next to wherever you spend your time, put a marker next to them, and when you have an idea, pick it up, mark it up, start playing.
Yeah. And I'll say one thing we mentioned, at least at some point in the podcast before, is that you don't need to make all your content from scratch either. If you are playtesting a Dixit-style game, you don't have to find your own Dixit cards.
Right.
If you're doing a drafting game and like the format of the drafting isn't the thing that you're testing, then just pick a card, pass left. There's a lot of other cute and creative ways of drafting cards, like tableau drafting and stuff, or rotisserie drafting, or all sorts of different things.
What's rotisserie drafting?
Rotisserie drafting is where the cards are all laid out and you take them one at a time from the tableau.
Oh, like networks.
I haven't played it, but sure.
I know that as a Rochester draft. That's I think the formal name for that.
Oh, okay.
Conversely, if you're testing a new drafting mechanism, pull out your copy of Sushi Go. Like, you don't need to invent new scoring to test the... So yeah, isolate what you're testing and just test that and don't worry about the rest. So...
You already know that deck building games exist. If you're making a deck building game, you don't need to figure out all the numbers from scratch. Grab your copy of Dominion or whatever and figure out what things are different and just tweak that copy. Basically, think of it like you're making an expansion for it or something like that. And then once you have proven your idea or your mechanic, then okay, this works. Now you can start worrying about other stuff.
The person who requested this is working on a game that has actually a really cute... It's like a pick and pass mixed with Brave Rats almost. Like, you pick a card... You pass the hand to the left, they draw a new card. So you always have the same number of options, but one of them is unknown. And then you play them simultaneously and reveal sort of Marvel Snap style, if that's how Marvel Snap works. I still haven't played that. And it's just a really cute little simple format. And then he made every card from scratch. And like that's fine because I played it in that form. Like, if you bring it to other people, you might want to start making content. But to test the premise, work out, it's in the name, what the minimum viable amount of stuff you need is to test that premise.
Yeah.
For my dungeon building game, I just need to see if it was fun to lay out cards into a little dungeon grid. That's all I needed to do, so that's all I did.
Yeah, I assure you, whatever you think the minimum is for your game, it's much less than
that. Yeah, you'll go to a prototype night and you will see someone who has got their game out for the first time and they've handcrafted minis and they've glued a tower together and... It's just he's such a red flag. What's that?
I said he's not exaggerating, people.
Yeah.
I saw someone with a wooden carved board who brought it to a playtest night. And I'm like, how many times have you playtested this? And he's like, oh, I haven't before. I'm like, you, what? He's like, yeah. And I've got like 10 more of these boards at home. I'm like, are you?
We're talking about first games. My first game, I love making content for games. So my first game, I think I made... hundreds of unique cards before pulling it out to the table and discovering every number was off. Like, I had everything doubling stuff, and once you double something three times, it's impossible. Like, that was the day I learned, oh, plus X is better than doubling because it doesn't magnify each and every time.
Doubling is wild.
Doubling is
if you stack, especially. Yeah.
So, first step that I would recommend is literally deck of cards next to you, blank cards, or I don't know why you wouldn't have blank cards, but you can find blank cards pretty easily around the world. Where do you get blank cards from, AJ?
So, I get blank cards from you. But I literally, when Peter and I first met each other, he always had all these printed off cards that he didn't need anymore because he'd like prototype with them then get to the next iteration. And I'd just take all of his blank playing cards, and that's what I would use for my first pass. Is I would just take the blank card and I would write on it and I'd be good to go.
Just cut paper into nines. Done.
Yep. Yeah, but I mean, if you printed off one set of cards already, well, cool, then you now have the set for the next one, right? That's what I use too, is like from some of my first prototypes, I would just take out the sheets that did. Oh, and we should probably be a little more specific here. If I'm prototyping cards, I have a card sleeve, I have a magic card. You can get land cards for basically free. If you go to like any card store, people will leave piles of cards after a draft and they are just free. They're worthless. And so you use that basically as like the backing of it. You need an opaque back to the sleeves. You slide in the magic card and with it you put in the sheet of paper that you have written on or printed
on. This is for like if you need double-sided cards or if you're playing with other people because it's more pleasant. If you are solo playing, even that is overkill.
A
cut up piece of paper is all you need. You can cut it up into squares if you want. It doesn't matter. You're just seeing if the basic idea works. One thing that I do if it's a slightly heavier game, like if it's a euro with any kind of currency, I will just get a pen and paper and I'll just manually denote what everyone has. So if I'm like in this game where I was playing three hands, I would just write down, oh, this person has three teeth at the moment. This person has four skulls. This person has five children. Tally it or cross it out or whatever you like. Like, it doesn't matter when you're testing the premise.
It's not much harder to just have a box of, like, miscellaneous colored cubes.
It's not much harder, but it makes me get up from my desk, and I'm looking for as few obstacles as possible. One thing worth noting, too, is that cards can replace almost any component if you need them to. If maybe your final game will have, I don't know, custom minis or something like that, for now it can just be a card. It really can. It doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if it has to fit on like a space on a grid, then use pennies. Like, as Peter says, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, just cut corners everywhere you can for this first playtest and for maybe even the next two playtests after that. Once I think something has got like that glimmer of fun I was talking about, once I'm like, oh, I'm enjoying this process, that's when I'll move maybe to the next level. So I will always solo test first, just here at my desk, pile of cards, piece of paper to track resources. I'll draw a map on a piece of paper and cut up shards of paper for the pieces. Like, I'll see if I can find some photos. Like, you would be amazed at how M and non-V my MVPs are. They are really, like, bare minimalistic just to test the premise. I just want to know. So, like, Baba Yaga, I picked up this deck of cards. I quickly wrote 10 different cards, shuffled them, dealt them out to three me's, handed them to the left, tracked stuff on a piece of paper, and by the end of that, I was like, okay, this is something. Like, this doesn't break. This doesn't fundamentally break. My next step is Component Studio. So, if you missed it, we just did a whole episode on Component Studio. But again, for this MVP, I'm just, like, just using a single field. So, if a card has
just
to have
the text on the card.
Text of the card. So if this card is worth, you know, 3 wood and 2 stone, I will write 3 wood, 2 stone in words. That's all you need. People can track that. Now, this is not advanced playtesting. This is MVP. I just want to be clear. Like, once you get to the point of, like, showing it to a bunch of non-gamers or bringing it to an event or something like that, put more effort in this. This is literally us talking about that first stage. So I will just have in Component Studio, I'll just make, you know, 20 cards and write out 1 wood, 3 stone, and then maybe a second field for the ability, maybe not even, maybe just put it all in one. One wood, 3 stone, take another turn, whatever it is. Put that in, export, you know, try to take as little time as possible. You will redo it better later. This is just to see if it works. This is if you have like a playtest group of some kind, because if, again, if you're playing with like non-gamers, they're going to be very confused and horrified. I spoke last time about the Las Vegas Strip. I brought that out for Sean and Jeff, and it was hideous. It was like, I used colors to denote the players, and it didn't quite work because one of them was colorblind. It was not colorblind friendly whatsoever. And it was just scroll on the cards, and sometimes it went off the card, and I was like, yeah, but you know what it means. From that, they were able to give enough notes that I rebuilt it, and it actually, like, didn't change much from that second iteration, genuinely. Like, I just needed to get something to the table. This is when I was racing against the clock and I had 45 minutes to go from the car to playtesting this game. So I threw it into Component Studio. I made it as ugly as fast as possible. I exported it. I put it in Tabletop Simulator. I dealt out the hands. That took me less than half an hour and I was ready to go.
Mm-hmm. One important thing that you briefly touched on that I think is worth emphasizing is that it is different if you're playing with non-gamers. If you are playtesting with a bunch of strangers or even like family members that don't play board games, in either of those situations, you probably need to put a little bit more effort. I do want to emphasize a little bit more effort, but that's strictly in the usability. So for instance, we were talking last week about how you can do icons in Component Studio and how Village Pillage is a very icon-based game. I'm sure in your first few playtests of that, you didn't feel any need to put an icon in it. That does make it much more usable, though. And so you may have to make some judgment calls about how much extra effort it takes to parse. For instance, I was recently working on a game that didn't have any icons on it, didn't have any art on it in its MVP. And very quickly, it was apparent that this was a stumbling block. Now, it's fine, because, again, that was my first playtest. Yeah. But, like, right after that, it's like, okay, it is actually very difficult for players to be able to parse what is on the cards because it's just a wall of text. And it is a game that really needs icons and stuff like that. So I guess it's less about like the very first, the very minimum, but it's like almost immediately afterwards, you do need to consider the usability of it. And more so if it's with people who already are at a disadvantage because they don't have familiarity with these games.
Yeah. I think it's definitely worth emphasizing that minimum viable means minimum viable. Like,
yes,
you can't playtest Dixit with blank cards. You just can't do it. You need something. Now, it doesn't need to be beautiful final finish cards. You could pull out a tarot deck and try it with that. You could, you know, pull up photos from the internet. Like, but you need to work out what the game needs to actually be viable. That is really key. One thing I skipped is deck of cards. Deck of cards will fill in for so many situations. As in a standard deck of playing cards. I've got a game, Critic Kitchen, coming to Kickstarter October 24th. Keep your eyes peeled. I have photos of the early playtest of this at a playtest night with other game designers, so we knew that they were okay with it. In this game, there are a bunch of central locations, and everyone simultaneously chooses where to send their things. Our central locations were ace through five of spades. Everyone's individual hands to choose were ace through five of another suit. We couldn't play it with more than three because there's only four suits in the deck of playing cards, but that was all we needed. We didn't need to print a single card for that. We just needed to be like, okay, cool. Like, you are sending to five. Great. Play your five next to here. That was all we needed.
Mm-hmm.
Deck of playing cards, so, so helpful. I also, again, I do this, I take this pretty seriously and I have the capacity to. I have a big shelf of prototype bits. I don't expect most people to have this many prototype bits. This has been my job for a decade, so I've built up a bunch over time. I like knowing that I can go over there and get whatever I need. I have meeples in 10 different colors. I have resource tokens from everything from wood to sheep to cows to skulls. Anything I need, I can walk over there and grab it. Now, for an MVP, you can absolutely fill out other stuff. But because I have it there, it's very easy for me to do. I think what everyone should have on hand if they're taking this seriously is meeples in different colors, cubes in different colors, and blank cards, and a deck of playing cards.
I think it might be worth going over some other types of components and talk about how to MVP them.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So things like, well, let's start with boards. What would you do for a board for an MVP? And maybe it's best if we said like your very first playtest and like the next step that's like still very rough.
Yeah, you know? So very first playtest, piece of paper, I'll scroll on it. I can show you so many photos of me scrolling on pieces of paper because that's all you need, especially if it's for you or for like someone else who gets what you're doing. You don't need to worry about anything other than, does it make sense that you care about this?
You know what I actually prefer doing rather than piece of paper is whiteboard, because you can modify things mid-playtest very easily.
Nice. That's good. That's smart. And then for the next one up, I'm trying to think. I don't make many games with maps or boards, so it doesn't come up for me, but I would probably either grab a board from another game or quickly throw something together, yeah. I don't make many games with boards, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, I think the gulf between the minimum and like the much more completed is very wide, and in that, I mean, I'm either going to just keep hand scribbling if I can get away with that, Or if I can't, then I'm going to start putting a lot more effort in much more quickly with that, because the board, you just have fewer options with that. And it can matter a lot very quickly.
My games have this distinct point of, I am taking this seriously now, and I will dedicate a few hours to building out a prototype with... Every designer builds their own kind of visual language over time. Like, you've played enough of my prototypes that you recognize when it's my prototype. I have fonts that I like. Yeah. I have icons that I like. And I will be like, oh, this is an actual game? Okay, let's sit down and put the work in.
I will say, my MVP looks different if it's digital or physical, particularly with the board, because doing a digital board is so much easier than doing a physical one. Because if you need a physical one, you're limited in like printing off paper, so you have to like do maybe multiple sheets and like tape them together and that kind of thing, and there's just some difficulties that can come along with that sort of thing. But digitally, you can do so many tiny details and manipulate it and update it very easily, where it can be a bit of a pain to update a physical board. So that is a big difference, digital versus physical. Also, just in terms of how pretty things look in general, I mean, it's just always nicer to prototype digitally. It's always going to look nicer, unless your physical is like exclusively printing stuff off, which you can do for sure. I think dice would be another important one. So how do you do with dice?
I was wondering if dice would be next. So I have a bunch of D6s, just standard 1 to 6, you know, with the pips. I will write next to them what they do. 1 is this, 2 is this, 3 is this, 4 is this, 5 is this, 6 is this. That is something I actually carry through for a long time. Like, you and I are working on this game where one of the factions has dice and the dice have unique sides. I brought that to Origins, and it had a little chart being like, here's what the 1 is, here's what the 2 is, here's what the 3 is, because actually mocking up a dice is a huge hassle.
Yeah, what you can do is stickers, especially if you have only a couple dice. Like, if you have 2 dice for your game, that's pretty easy to do with stickers.
Yeah.
But if you're talking, like, you know, even, like, 10 dice, like, 10 dice is actually a lot. That's 60 faces. And if you have to make a change, that's a change to a lot of them if there's duplicates. Yeah.
I used to, and I should get some more, have just blank white cubes, like dice, and I would marker on them. So I would manually make these dice.
Right, but even then, like, it's a pain. B, it's actually not always that much better, because, like, part of it is it's dry erase. It can rub off a bit.
Yeah, this is with, like, a marker.
Oh, were you permanent? Oh, yeah. Yeah,
that's probably why I ran out.
I had a game that was real time and used dice, and because it's real time dice, it needs to be instantly identifiable. So I had to do the manual, every single face is exactly like it is.
Yeah.
And because I did that permanently, it's like, well, if I want to redo it, I'm going to have to sticker them in. Draw over them again. Physical dice can be a pain. And again, digitally, it's so easy. This is why I love TTS, man. So good. Other components. Player shields, I think, are super easy. That's like just piece of paper and
or
fold
box.
It.
Box lids are great for that.
Couldn't be easier for that.
Here's something that Jeff Fraser, friend of the podcast, does that I find really interesting. He will, in the early stages of his designs, deliberately not do reference cards or reference sheets of any kind, because one of the things that he's testing is how well you retain it without it being written in front of you. Some games need them, it's just inevitable, and even games that don't, I recommend for the final published version putting it out there for people who are more visual. But he really deliberately is like, look, here are the actions you can take on a turn. They're not written anywhere. He doesn't say this, but he'll not write them down anywhere, so that he can track how many times people are like, oh, I forgot you could do this, or like how easily they retain them, which I just think is really interesting.
Yeah.
It's like a stress test.
Mm-hmm. So some listeners might take an excuse for laziness, what I'm about to say about me, not Jeff, but I find that when I'm prototyping as well, I'm pretty comfortable having my very ugly prototypes for longer than most other designers would be comfortable with, and maybe than I should, but it also helps me to identify, similarly to Jeff, like, what things are issues. And, like, some things are only issues because they're visual, like the example I gave earlier, but some of them, it could be an issue in that it's an unintuitive mechanic, and if you smooth over it too nicely with graphic design, then it might not be as clear that it's an issue, because it's still an issue, it's still coming up. But it's coming up in like different ways or different contexts, or you have like a different perspective on it because you've got this other feature that's smoothing out. Maybe the smoothing out just solves the problem entirely.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I don't disconnect mechanic from UI. Like, I see it all as UX. So mm-hmm. I see what you're saying. I don't think you're wrong. My brain doesn't work like that. I mm-hmm. talked about this a little bit last time. I always want to make the game as close to the final form as I can.
Yeah, I get that.
And so my prototypes, they're not pretty, but they're very, very clean. I never want my prototype to get in the way of the game. That's what I'm really working hard to avoid.
Yeah.
And so I've gotten, very good at this clean language that doesn't get in the way of the game. And a lot of the time, I will build it around making it intuitive, because I don't think that's hiding a bad mechanic. I think that is the mechanic. Sometimes I run into issues when publishers are like, yeah, we changed this. And I'm like, oh, you are going to see pretty quickly that, like, players are not going to understand this. And sure enough, players, like, in the next playtest, they're like, man, this mechanic used to work really well, and no, it doesn't. It's like, yeah, you took away the tools that, I guess you could make the argument, are propping up a weak mechanic, but I think they are just, they are the mechanic in my mind.
Yeah, no, I get that. It's you're just looking at it from a more holistic sense.
Yes,
right?
Yes. For me, like, games are a very holistic medium.
Mm-hmm.
You can't separate the person from the UI from the game.
Mm-hmm. What are some other super common components that could be a pain to prototype?
Dials, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good one. But most of the time, you don't actually need dials, right? Like, if it's like a hidden number that you have to figure out, you just write down what the number is.
Well, that's what I was going to say, actually. Like, you can get away with stuff in a prototype that you wouldn't, so in a published game. So, like, if a published game, like, if Scythe said, at the start of this combat, write down the number that you want to commit, people would be like, really? Like, with a pen? What is this? And so the dial fixes that. But, for the sake of testing the mechanic, not the component, you can absolutely get away with, like, just write it down. Or I'm sure there are other examples. I can't think of them right now. But there's definitely times when I've been like, yeah, obviously in the real game we'd have this. But for now, just know that it's that. There's a story about Wavelength. When they were prototyping Wavelength, Wavelength has this beautiful plastic contraption that, like, hides and reveals where on an arc a line is. And when they were prototyping that, people were like, well, this is fun, but how is this going to actually exist? And then I think that someone who designed it was an engineer or something like that. They're like, no, trust me, this can work. And so then it got made, and it obviously is this beautiful contraption. But there was definitely this hesitation of, like, how is that going to be possible?
I think the really big one that we haven't mentioned so far isn't a specific component, but a genre of game. Can you guess
deck
what
builders?
I'm talking about? Nope.
Chess.
I mean,
Dexterity. No, dexterity.
Dexterity, yes. So with dexterity games, those have to be basically exactly as they're going to be in the final version of the game, because what you're testing is the component, realistically.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've never worked on anything even dexterity adjacent, I don't think. Meow is probably the closest, and that's really not a dexterity game. It's all cards. But yeah, I see what you're saying. I know with Junkart, Sen Fung Lim and Jay Cormier, they went to the workshop and pulled out some wood and some saws and started making stuff.
Yep.
I've definitely seen people make dexterity games out of normal items. Like, they've taken something that exists in the real world and started playing a dexterity game with this because it has some component, no pun intended, some element of it, of the component that, like, is just interesting, and then they've worked out how to duplicate that to a board game.
Do you know how Ice Cool started?
No, do you?
About those ones. No, I don't.
I think the only thing I know is that they started with the shape. They knew that that shape was so interesting because it's, like, got a thick base, but the center of gravity is not where you think it would be, and it's got a point and all this kind of stuff. I mean, there's a whole industry of toy makers, and that's adjacent to game makers, and they are very physical, and they're very patent-based as a people as well.
Right, yeah. I think it's also really important to note that aside from the physical components of the MVP, you don't need to have the whole game there. Like you alluded to with your very first example, you just had some lines, some roads or some tunnels, and you were just connecting them and seeing, is it fun to physically connect these? Like in Carcassonne, you just need to put the pieces together and say, oh, I'm making this fun path and doing these
shapes. It's inherently fun.
How the scoring works. Yeah. And so when we're doing MVPs, we might not have an end condition. We might not know how you're going to progress through the game. We might just say, for the sake of this playtest, just try to do this.
Yeah.
And just play around with the components for a few minutes, you know?
Show and Tile is by Isaac Shalev and Matt Loomis, and I was at the con where Isaac was messing with this idea, and he sat me down. He's like, "Hey, try to do this." And I might have even asked, like, "What's the scoring?" He's like, "Doesn't matter. Like, I don't care about that. Here's the incentive. I will work out the specifics later, but right now, here is the incentive. Is this fun?" And I loved it. Obviously, we signed it and published it and printed thousands of copies. So obviously that worked for me, but like exactly that. He didn't have anything. He just had, is it fun to do this thing? And from there, built and built and built.
Mm-hmm. And then a more obvious version of that would be, let's take Gloomhaven, for example. I'm sure Gloomhaven didn't start with, oh, and here's the giant overarching campaign structure. I'm sure it first started with, how do these guys fight? How does this card combat work? How does the enemy AI work? And started with that and then built on top of that, right? Like, that time you killed me. That time you killed me didn't start by saying, oh, we're going to have all these module packs and here's player powers and stuff. Yeah. It started with three boards, three dudes per team, and let's just move them around.
It's funny, not to harp on about this, but this is why Cozy Hollow, I was like, look, I don't get this because I am resistant to this idea of like, look, this isn't fun now, but later I will add something that makes it fun. So I've done the opposite of this. I've got a game called Agricultus that I've probably been talking about for as long as we've been doing this podcast, where the core action is fun. It's a fun little puzzle, and I have never gotten a game working around it.
Yeah, I hear you.
7 years on, I've been trying, and that's one of the examples of like where I just abandoned it, because I was like, yeah, I can work on something for years and years and years, and eventually I can think of games where I eventually made something work out of something that wasn't fun to begin with. But if it's not fun at the start, as Agricultus even was, I just don't know how I get it to fun later, compared to moving on to the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. And in fact, the next thing you and I worked on, the core was fun straight away. Now, we took a month, 2 months to get the rest of like the system working before we could even start building content. But that core action selection of our game was fun from draft one. So that's why I was like, cool, like, I know that we can now make this part fun, because the thing that you do is fun and we can build on that. Again, I'm not trying to...
No, not at all. No, yeah,
dismiss Cozy Hollow. That's just where I'm coming from with it.
For sure. Actually, that might be a nice segue. You know, let's give a concrete example. We're not going to do like a whole dev diary right now or whatever, but let's just talk through Battle Bugs. Let's just talk through like the very beginning of that, where we started and what we did. Well, so, does that make sense?
Yeah, I can tell you the story. You and I were sitting at your kitchen table, and I had just come up with a mechanism for a Euro game.
And I wanted to steal it from him.
I really like it. I still think that there's more to be done with that. I just haven't, because we've been working so intently on Battle Bugs.
Because I stole it from him.
Because you stole it. So the mechanism was very simple. It was, there's X things, and you shuffle them up and pair them, and whenever you take an action, you take the paired action. So at the time I was trying to work on like a city builder, so like one action was get plans, and one action was build, and one action was get funding, and one action was get steel, and so on and so forth. And I had this real appeal to the idea of, you shuffle them up, and this time you get plans and then build. That's great. You can build the plans you just got. Next time, maybe it's build and then get plans. So you have to have gotten plans on an earlier turn and then build them and then get new plans. Maybe it's get steel and then build, so you know that you'll have the steel necessary to build when there's a paired. That was the idea. And there's just something about the modularity and replayability of that just really appealed. Like, we did the math at one point, but if you have 10 things, then they shuffle in 32,000 ways or something crazy like that. And the idea being that every different combination feels different. I never got that game working. I played it with Tim Armstrong, who's a designer friend of mine, and he basically then was like, oh, I see the issue, is that all these actions just feel kind of too similar. I had a thing that was like, get a steel, another thing that was like, get a wild, which could include steel, one that was get two wood, etc. And it just didn't work. And it just wasn't there. But I mentioned this premise, this is before I even playtested that game, to AJ.
So immediately I was like, that sounds so cool. I love that. I was like, that could be done for so many different games. I could just immediately picture how incredible this mechanic was. I still think you could do dozens, hundreds of games of this. This could be like a new worker placement, you know.
I don't think it's quite that fancy, but I appreciate your enthusiasm.
I think there's so much potential there. And so we had already been floating the possibility of working together on a two-player dueling game, because I'm a huge fan of two-player dueling games. and you want to stretch your design muscles and you hadn't worked on one before.
I also like how much content they require. Like, making content is my single favorite thing about game design, and dueling games demand content.
Mm-hmm. So we already had this idea floating in our minds, but we hadn't really talked much about what we would actually do with it. And basically, immediately, I was like, this would be a perfect fit for a dueling game where we want to have different characters or different factions. That's like kind of a given with that genre. And each faction could have their own set of special actions. And so that way, every time you pair up, not only is the combination of those four different terms of which position they're in, but the actions themselves are completely different because, you know, you're playing against a different faction who has a different action tile. And so the first thing we did, because we'd been playing some Neuroshima Hex, and Neuroshima Hex is awesome. And
Neuroshima Hex is significant because it's one of the few games that overlaps in our tastes. AJ and I have diametrically opposite tastes in games, but Neuroshima Hex we both quite like.
Mm-hmm. And so that was a good starting foundation point of, we want to make a dueling game. We both love this game. Maybe there's some element or some direction of that that can inform what we want to do with our dueling game. And so with this action selection mechanism in mind, we decided to try and make an MVP. What did we do? We just grabbed Neuroshima Hex and said, okay, there's some actions in Neuroshima Hex. There's a battle action. There's a move. There's a rotate. There's push. There's drawing tiles from the bag. There's playing tiles. There's all these things. And not all of them are like quite one-to-one translating in terms of
But for the sake Neuroshima of just playtesting the concept. Again, MVP, we weren't looking for what the final form would be. So I think we literally just took two factions. We're like, here's your four base actions. Here's mine. Shuffle them up. Pair them up. I'm going to take an action, you're going to respond, etc., etc. And that was great, because immediately we were like, oh, it doesn't work if you go, then I go, then you choose what I do. Like, it was just stuff like that that's so basic. Like, nowadays I teach people, and I don't think anyone even occurs to them that you could do it another way, because we found the logical, like, the intuitive way to do it. But even something as simple as, like, I choose an action that determines your action, there is so much turn-based, like, choices as a designer that you can make there. And that MVP helped us iron that out straight away. Yeah. And, more importantly, see that it was fun.
Yeah, and there's a lot of things where it's like, because we were literally just playing Neuroshima Hex but using a different action selection, there's a lot of things that instantly didn't translate, and, like, the game has moved miles and miles away from it, as we knew
it would. You wouldn't play it and think, like, oh, this is Neuroshima Hex.
Yeah.
Because it's not, and it never was.
Almost immediately, it just informed a lot of design decisions. It's like, in Neuroshima Hex, you have to really be explicit about which direction you're facing to do an attack. And almost immediately, it was like, all right, this directional facing attack does not work in this build. Or maybe it took a little bit longer for that one, but it was still, like, while we were messing around with the Neuroshima style.
And
that was our very first build, was just, does this action selection mechanism that we want to test work? And so we tested it in a similar style of game. The action selection worked. Obviously, the implementation didn't work. We didn't care about that. So then we moved on, and we were like, okay, now understanding the things that didn't work and knowing that we want to have asymmetric factions in some different directions than Neuroshima Hex took, and knowing that we want some different style mechanics, we want a different tempo, we want different movement and stuff like that, we built out two different factions that could possibly work. And what I built was, for the first one, it was the dung beetle, and what was the other one that I did?
It was bees, with the queen bee with the big butt.
Oh, yeah, right. So the first playtest that we started with the premise of, I want to do some very different things, just like throw stuff at the wall and sort of see what works, right? So I had one unit that took up multiple spaces, and like particular directions if you attack it had weak points. And then this other one, it was 1 liter, and then it was like this invincible ball that they would have to like aim, and the ball had its own mechanics that would like launch it around.
It's so funny, because not to shame you in front of our audience, but that prototype felt very not MVP to me, because you were trying a bunch of like quite sophisticated stuff that even now isn't in the game. Like you had this one character, like you said, took up multiple spaces, and moving that character was so complex. Like, that's what we kept bumping on. We just couldn't work out how to do it. And so for me, like, a truer MVP would have not had that extra complication.
Right. I think you're right. I think that was too complicated for an MVP. But I think this also speaks a bit to, like, why we bumped on Cozy Hollow. Because for you, you were like, was the absolute minimum it could possibly be. And for me, I'm like, I can't see the game with that little in there. And so I think you're right. I think I do think I went overboard regardless of my style for what it ended up being for that first prototype that was outside the Nourishima Hex style. And you definitely brought back in the next build as like, okay, a bit more abstract, a bit more like cerebral and just trying to figure out, is moving pieces around going to function? How does that supposed to look? And then I think anything past that we talk about would end up being like Desire Diary stuff and not MVP related.
Yeah. But we definitely we literally pulled out Nourishima Hex, shuffled tokens, put them down, played a few rounds, and just proved the concept. And that, here's the thing, that's all an MVP needs to do. It just needs to prove the concept. Mm-hmm. You don't have, and we're just going to debate about, we're just going to bicker about Cozy Hollow all day. Like, for me, the concept of Cozy Hollow was never proven. And that's why, I mean, we had other projects that I was more excited about. So I was like, bye AJ, bye forever. I was just like, yeah, I'm not feeling this. And I struggle to work on a theme I'm not feeling on it. I'd rather work on something I'm feeling.
I mean, the other one that we were working on was Battlebugs.
Yeah. So like all you need to do is what's the minimum viable stuff you can do to test the very premise of this game. So that's components, mechanics. There is a third element that I want to talk about a little bit before we go, which is getting it to the table. And this, I suspect, is probably the most challenging for most people. And this is one where I think you actually have more to offer than I do, because I get to the table in one of three ways. One is that I just solo test it. Like, great. I can do that all day, every day. I played Baba Yaga so many times before showing it to anyone else. By the time Baba Yaga went to everyone else, it was outside of MVP territory. I had properly mocked it up and all this kind of stuff, because I had played multiple full games by myself, which took hours. It was so time consuming. But I knew that the game functioned from start to finish. So I was like, look, I'm going to get this to other people and I don't want my prototype getting in the way. I'll make a nice version. I don't always do that. That was a weird week for me. So number one is solo testing. Number two is I try to book regular events. So there's a monthly playtest in LA. I've got a friend who I was playtesting with every 2 weeks, stuff like that. Because then I know when I can get to the table. I have a day. You and I had a Thursday night meeting for Battlebugs for months. Months and months and months. We knew that on Thursday night we would get together. So when do we get to the table was never a challenge. And then the third thing I do is I'm very lucky in that I've been doing this for a decade. I have a little Facebook group of people who playtest my games. And so I can ping that group and be like, hey, who wants to playtest my games? And people are like, I want to playtest your games. And I'm like, cool. So those are the three ways that I get stuff to the table. If you can't solo test, and if you don't live in a city where there's constant events, and if you haven't been an established designer for a decade and have people who play just your games, how do you reliably get stuff to the table?
You're not asking me personally, right? You're asking me for my advice for people?
Yes, both. How do you do it, and how would you recommend people do it?
How do I do it? Well, I'm very popular.
So. With who? Parents. I forgot about them.
I have played with my parents before. I try not to, but they are very good sports.
I was insulting you, but...
Oh, that's fine. So I personally have curated a number of recurring playtest groups. So I have various groups and have various uses for the groups in different ways. So we've referenced the Toronto crew, who are fabulous, but it's a big group of designers. So if I go there, I know that's going to be my entire night is playtesting other people's prototypes as well as mine, which is completely fair, but it is a lot of time for it. So that's really useful when I need to get really high quality feedback from our designers. If I'm stuck on a problem, if I'm playtesting a game that needs a decent sized group, because there's a pretty consistent group there, those are sort of the uses that I have for them.
I'll also say that, especially if you're a new designer, you should be playtesting other people's games. You absolutely should be avoiding it. I still playtest other people's games all the frickin' time.
Me too. Yeah. And then I've got other groups with more casual people, and they have an entirely different use. For me, the more casual gamers that they play but they don't design, those are really useful for the earlier stages where it's just is anything fun here? I basically just need a warm body, not to be too
That's your equivalent of solo testing.
Right. Yeah, it's I just need to bounce off this thing. I'm going to make changes. And this has to be very clear to people going into it. They're this is rough. This is my goal of this playtest. We are not going to necessarily play a whole game, or there might not even be a whole game to test. This is my goal for today. I'll always say this is the thing that I want to figure out before the playtest to make sure that they understand what's going on. And I want to set expectations for what's going to look like. And then, okay, now we can begin, now I can mess around. And they also need to know if I'm going to be making changes on the fly. If two turns in, I'm like, wow, I have like half the HP that I need to be able to play this. It's like, okay, I'm just going to double it. And you can't do that with every group, but if you establish it up front that that is what is going to happen, then I think pretty much everybody's going to be okay with it.
Yeah. So if not, you know not to do it with that particular person.
Right. And so, like, how did I find these people? Well, I'm in some playtesting Facebook groups, and I kept an eye out, and there was, you know, someone who was like, hey, I'm available to playtest. And then I just set up a recurring playtest with them. So every single week, I know I've got that one person for a nice one-on-one, very, like, easy, light, doesn't have too many expectations coming with it. I've got
recurring events are really key. Like, it's such a weird thing. Like, AJ and I are not schedule-driven people. I would happily burn every calendar in the world, but not everything in the world, for me. I would happily never live by a calendar again. I don't like that. It doesn't work for my brain. But having a regularly scheduled playtest is valuable, A, because it means that you will do it, and B, because you're never like, oh, I have this game and I don't know when. Like, you know when you're going to be able to play it. You'll be able to play it at the next scheduled playtest. Done.
It also takes a lot of time and effort to schedule a playtest if it's not recurring. If it's recurring, it's done. It's just, it's going to happen. If you have to wrangle together three people every week to be able to do something, or every time you want to play test, like, that's another barrier to entry to getting your game on the table. It's a big pain. And yeah, so like other designers I've just met through going to design events. I play this with a listener who I met up with every week. Shout out to Aaron. And I also play this off and on with like lots of other random people, our friend Kevin. Because I've gone to events, I met people, and that's like probably the most useful advice I can give for playtesting with other designers who are going to give you the best feedback and who it's going to be fair to playtest with, because unless someone really actively likes playtesting, which some people do, you know, my casual gamer actively just enjoys playtesting games week after week. But for the most part, at least for me, I really feel like I owe people, you know? And
playtesting a game with someone is presenting them with a thing that you know is not going to be fun a lot of the time. Yeah. Like, hey, this is honestly a big reason I solo test as much as I do. I hate being like, hey, do you want to not have some fun for a while in the hope that eventually this thing will be fun? Like, it's miserable. It really works against my spirit.
And, you know, iron sharpens iron. If you're playtesting with other designers and you're trying to become better designers, you've got someone to bounce ideas off of. You've got a sounding board. You're going to, you know, what's the saying? A rising tide lifts all ships, you know?
Yeah, the Toronto group has produced some fantastic designs in the last, like, few years. It's been phenomenal.
And, like, not to make you guys jealous of, like, our playtest group, other amazing playtest groups exist all over the place. And if you just seek out local cons, you don't have to go to every local con, but if you go to one or two of them and just go out of your way to try and meet people just by playtesting their games, being friendly, you know, being open, that kind of thing, then you can meet people that you can playtest with on a recurring basis. If they're local, great. But even if they're not, maybe they can play on TTS with you. You know, I play all of my playtesting on TTS because I live in the middle of nowhere, as Peter likes to tease me about.
7 hours out of Toronto.
It's not 7 hours out of Toronto.
It's not Toronto either, so who knows. There are lots and lots of Facebook groups. Board Game Design Lab. I think, does Joe Slack have a Facebook group, or does he just do it all through Discord?
He must. Chris Bakke has a playtest Discord as well.
A lot of them have also moved to Discord. I know I'm in like 7 different playtest Discords. I don't have time to go to them, but they are there. They are public. You can join. You can start coming along. They'll do monthly events or weekly events or random events, but there are ways to get your games to the table. It is possible.
And I can't stress enough, even if you go to these events like once or twice, go there to make contacts. You don't have to wait for whenever these things are meeting up. You can meet people there, and then you can get recurring places. And especially if you want to co-design, great place to meet co-designers.
Oh,
which, by the way,
is
the other way of getting your game to the table, is if you have a co-designer, you always have someone to playtest with.
Yeah, strong recommendation. If you have a co-designer, make sure your game has a two-player mode. Alex and I are working on Critter Kitchen, coming to Kickstarter October 24th. And everyone who plays that is like, oh, this goes down to two? I don't think this would be fun at two. And we're like, we made sure it was fun at two. Alex and I have played more two-player games than I think any other player count has ever been played, because we play it... When we play it, we tend to play like three or four games in a row, and we've been doing this for over a year. So, like, once this comes out, hopefully that will not be true, but I can promise you that two-player mode, we have made sure that that is fun. AJ and I are obviously working on a BattleBugs is two-player, and it just means that you can get together with your co-designer and play the game. Now, that shouldn't entirely replace other playtesters, but it really helps with... Especially, like, with BattleBugs, there's so many different factions, so it's very easy to be like, hey, here's an MVP of a faction. We know the system works. Does this work? Let's try it.
We sort of touched on this already, but one thing to emphasize is that when you're playtesting your MVP, you do not have to finish it. And this, like, goes through, you know, all the way through to the end. When we were playtesting BattleBugs, I can't tell you how many times we were playing and having fun playing it, but we had already worked out what the next problem to solve was, what the next fun problem to solve was. And so we'd be like, oh, yeah, this card needs to change to this. And even though we were having fun playing our great game, which you should buy whenever it comes in.
Someday.
We would still pause the game, reset it, you know, mid-game. I think designers just get, like, sort of tunnel vision. It's like, oh, we're playing the game. We're going to finish the game. I almost never finish playing a game when I'm playtesting. I would say 90% of the time, I do not bother finishing the game during a playtest because I don't need to. I've already learned the thing that I need to learn. Why are we saying what's time? And I mean, if the players want to continue, great. I mean, I have had playtests where I was like, oh, let's stop. And they were like, no, I'm having fun. I would like to finish it. Great. Well, sure. Yeah. Let's do it.
I'll take it.
You got me.
Yeah. Same thing. Alex and I were testing a bunch of modular content for Critter Kitchen. We came up with like 20 ideas because I love content generation. And we could only play like two or three of them per game. So we would just play enough to be like, this does or doesn't work, reset, fix, new ones in. Speaking of stuff that we've already touched on, I cannot overemphasize enough how good Component Studio is for getting MVPs to the table. I feel like I undersold it earlier. Every step of the process is made easier by Component Studio. If you're going to... I solo tested Baba Yaga on TTS by just writing in the text in Component Studio, exporting it into TTS mode, putting it straight into the app. AJ taught me a trick that I didn't even know, which is when you export from Component Studio, you don't even need to download the file and upload it into TTS. You can just copy the URL straight from Component Studio, put it into TTS, and you're good to go. It's amazing.
Now, if you do that, you should quickly just tap the date and change that to in the future when it's going to expire, because normally it expires like within a month of it coming out.
And so I would just normally agree with you, but for MVPs, you don't have to worry about that.
Right. That is true. That is true. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Anything else on MVPs?
That's it for me.
Again, I said this earlier, but I just want to really make it clear. The goal of an MVP is to get it to the table as fast as possible for 2.5 reasons. Half a reason is that your time is apparently valuable. Number one reason is because the less time you spend on it, the more you'll be willing to change. And being willing to change your game is the only way I know to improve games. If you're resisting change, your game is going to stagnate and be... You don't want your first version to be the best version of your game. That's awful. You want that to be the worst version for it to improve, improve, improve. The less time you spend on it, the more willing you are going to be to make changes because you're not emotionally attached. But then, for me especially, because the way I work, the less time I spend making the game... A, the more games I can literally make, but B, the more likely I am to pull out an idea. That could be nothing. I've had two games published or signed where I was like, is this an idea? I don't know. Oh, I've got a playtest coming up. It'll take me 5 minutes to put it together. Okay, done. And they both got signed. So, like, had I had that resistance, had I had that inertia, I would have two fewer signed games. Not even exaggerating. One thing we didn't talk about is that in TTS, you can pull out a pen and just scroll on the board. Scroll on the table, scroll on the cards. I've done that so many times for an MVP.
Yep. If I want to do a reference card in TTS for my MVP, I'll just click text and I'll just type something up. And I'll just say, like, actions, deal one damage, whatever.
or just building a map by just making squares and circles on the table. Like, all that kind of stuff I've done. It's just about getting it to the table as fast as possible.
You can also save components between, in TTS, you can save components between mods. Yeah. And so it's like, oh, I want to have a, you know, square grid board. Done. Because I already have one from a different project, right?
Yeah, and it has a playing card thing. And again, playing cards are invaluable. They're so useful to replace other components. Hey, AJ, I have a problem.
Is it fun?
It's not enough fun.
Ah.
How can we fix this, AJ?
Y'all know what time it is.
Everyone's least favorite part of the podcast, where we're all forced to have fun.
Peter, who is the MVP in your life?
Who's the minimum viable prototype? I was going to say, my son's pretty minimum viable.
who's the person who's, like, helped you the most, you know, in your life?
No question. My best friend, Nicole.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
Nicole has saved me again and again and changed my life, and I love her, and we are going to be platonically together forever. She is my MVP. I adore her. Not a very interesting story, but it's a fact. I love her. She's also very, oh man, on top of all the things that she does, that's amazing as a friend. Like, on top of all of that, you know what she went and did?
What?
She went and married a guy who I can co-design with. Just like, she married Alex. So my co-designer Alex, his wife is my best friend in the world. I love her. Adora, we'll sing her praises for the rest of my life. And she married a game designer, and she was like, maybe you two could design together. And I was like, oh, that's a cute thought, that me and a random person will be good at co-designing. Just maybe don't get your hopes up. Maybe don't expect anything to come of this. And I met him, and I was like, he's nice. Like, yeah, he's trying a little hard. He's funny, but, you know. Here's my first impression of Alex. He seems like the kind of person who, if you invited him onto a podcast, his episode would be impossible to edit. I just immediately got that vibe from him. No, so, like, almost immediately. Like, they'd been married for days when we sat down and made one of my favorite games I've made and then another one of my favorite games I made. So, yeah. On top of all of her, like, amazing personal attributes, she went and married my primary co-designer. What a woman. Your answer is going to be very... Oh, go ahead.
I can't believe she did all that just for you.
I know. She's very selfless. Your answer is going to be very boring because you're married.
Yeah, it is. I guess I should answer with someone who isn't my wife. That makes more sense, right?
You can do a little spiel about your wife to lead into the second option if you want.
No, she's pretty boring. She's great, but she's, you know...
Isn't she like
nothing
13?
Interesting to say. I will stick with my wife.
I like how you're like, you know what? I've been thinking about it. I'm going to stick with my wife. Yeah, I was on the fence for a while there, but I've decided I'm going to stay with her.
I'm going to stick with my wife because she literally saved my life. Did you know that?
No, I did not know that.
Yeah, so...
Was she about to kill you and she changed her mind? Because that doesn't really count.
So we were at a party one time, and this is not characteristic of me, by the way. I do not go to parties, and I was drinking, which is not characteristic of me. I do drink, but I don't get drunk. I have, like, a beer every now and then type of thing.
I don't even do that. I'm even more boring.
Yeah. But in this very rare instance, I was at a party, and I was not super comfortable with people. And so I drank to be more comfortable with people, because I was very uncomfortable, because I do not like parties. So I got very drunk, and then I was, like, choking on my own vomit when I was
when I went to sleep.
And she, luckily, hadn't been drinking much, woke up to that sound, you know, pushed me over and took care of me. So, literally, would not be alive without her.
I was trying to tie it into Breaking Bad, but I can't get there. Well, that's so lovely. Who would your second choice have been? I'm going to guess Brent.
Nah, see... I think it has to be you.
Oh, that's even more boring.
I know. I don't want it to be. I tried really hard for it to not be. That's why
you're lucky
wife.
You're married then.
Yeah. No, because, like, my aspirations are to be a game designer. That's all I want to do. I just want to design games all day, every day. That's what I would love to be able to do for work. I mean, I don't want to do it all day, every day. But
maybe once a year or so. maybe every decade is a special treat.
But it's like my favorite thing to do. It's super fun, and it's been a dream of mine to be a game designer as long as I've realized that was like a potential career path, no matter how unlikely. Like, not only have you like helped me along with that a lot, but like it's been a super fun part of the journey getting to do this type of thing with you. We worked together at a board game publisher that that you hired me for. We worked together on games. We worked together on this podcast. Like, the amount of things that we do together eclipses like all my other friendships, and like it's great. And like from a selfish standpoint, it's very useful being friends with you because you know a lot about games, and like that's great.
How I get them. Utility.
But and I know you don't like hearing this, but I also love you a lot. And
I love you too. So, I don't hate love. I'm all about love.
It was the I was being facetious, of course, but it was the I think this was an off-air conversation we had where you were like, "Oh, do people just love me for me and not my talent or something?"
I don't remember saying that.
It was because you were talking about how I was saying that you were an extremely likable person. And you're like, "Yeah, I know. It can be." I forget the exact phrasing.
Okay. This is subtly different to the way that you framed it. I know what you're talking about.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm saying that playtesting games can be challenging because, and this is going to sound very modest, I'm very charming and likable. That is an unfortunate fact of my existence. So this is where you're getting this from. I'm like, I'm so lovable that when I playtest a game, I don't know if people are enjoying the game or if I'm just good at teaching and like it's fun to run a game with me. And it genuinely it's the most damn humble brag ever. Like, I'm not trying to. I'm saying like it genuinely can be an issue. And I'm like, I need to know if this thing that I made is good, separate to how incredibly lovable I am.
But seriously, no, that is an issue. I played Blood on the Clock Tower once, and everyone from there like walked away being like, "That was a great game," and I was like, "That was a great DM."
Okay, well, let's tease.
Yes, let's.
I've got a good one. You ready?
Yeah, hit me.
OILS.
Is that an acronym?
No.
Let's see.
Blank. What is OILS?
OILS. Okay, well, stay tuned where Peter explains to me what the heck he's talking about.
That's all for this week. Thank you for listening to both AJ and I rave about how incredibly lovable I am, as will be the case in every episode. The only thing I love more than myself is Component Studio. And my couches. Have I told you about my couches?
No, but they can't possibly be better than Component Studio.
Oh, they're right up there. They're really good.
I know, you might need to sit on my couch, because it might not be the best couch in the world, but it's the only couch that can possibly fit in my basement. Did you see the picture? I literally had to destroy the door frame, destroy multiple sections of wall and ceiling to get this couch down my stairs, and it is never coming out, and I'm never getting that couch down there.
Someday my housemate will move out, and I'll have a guest room, and you will come fly down to LA for a trip, and you will experience my couches, and you will understand.
All right.
It is impossible to oversell these couches. They are...
Listen, you undersold Component Studio, so I'm going to assume this is the Component Studio of couches.
This is why I'm saying, like, the only thing I like more than myself are Component Studio and my couches. That's it. End of list. That's all from us. Thanks so much for listening, and talk to you next time.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter at Fun Problems Pod, or reach us via email at funproblemspodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you, and if you enjoyed the podcast, please tell a friend.